I'm VOA's Joe Ramsey with your worldwide news update. The U.S. has sent Israel a letter warning it risks losing American weapons funding unless it allows far more humanitarian aid into Gaza. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
The letter was not meant as a threat,
but rather, White House National Security spokesman John Kirby says it was meant to reiterate a sense of U.S. urgency
about the need for an increase, a dramatic increase in humanitarian assistance.
The U.S. is giving Israel 30 days to, among other things, speed the aid flow, which had ramped up after a similar letter in April. But State Department spokesman Matthew Miller says the flow has dropped sharply.
By over 50% from where it was at its peak.
The letter comes amid growing U.S. frustration as Israel has defied repeated requests to scale back operations against Hamas. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump is refusing to say whether he's spoken with Russian President Vladimir Putin since Trump left the White House.
Well, I don't comment on that, but I will tell you that if I did, it's a smart thing. If I'm friendly with people, if I have a relationship with people, that's a good thing, not a bad thing, in terms of a country.
The Republican presidential candidate Tuesday was pressed on his communication with the Russian president during a wide-ranging and sometimes contentious interview at the Economic Club of Chicago. Trump touted his relationship with Putin, as well as the authoritarian leaders of North Korea and China.
I had a very good relationship with President Xi, and a very good relationship with Putin, and a very good relationship with Kim Jong-un, who has a nuclear force that you won't even believe.
Journalist Bob Woodward reports in his new book, Trump had as many as 7 private phone calls with Putin since leaving office. This is VOA News. An independent commission in Bangladesh formed after the August ouster of Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina is investigating enforced disappearances during her rule. VOA's Sarah Zaman reports from the capital, Dhaka.
Rights groups say over 700 people, mostly political opponents and rights activists, went missing during Hasina's last 15 years in office. Aisha Ali's son, Abdul Qadir Bhuiya Masoom, has been missing since December 2013.
I keep waiting for my son to call me Ma once again, for him to say, Mother, how are you?
Bangladesh's interim government formed a 5-member commission to investigate cases of enforced disappearances. Ali hopes it will help her find her son. Working behind closed doors, the commission is a ray of hope for many, but the pace of its work is frustrating to some. Sarah Zaman, VOA News, Dhaka.
Floods have brought devastation to parts of West and Central Africa over the past several months. Reuters correspondent David Doyle has more.
Over the last few months, heavy rains have flooded every one of Chad's 23 provinces. In northern Nigeria, a dam burst with devastating consequences. Ancient buildings have been damaged in Niger's desert town, Agadez. And amid that destruction, the human cost. More than 1,460 people dead, according to the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. Usman Tijani Sugi is the Director of Meteorological Observations and Forecasting at Chad's National Meteorological Agency.
Houses have collapsed, bridges have given way, roads have completely been destroyed, and vehicles have been swept away, especially in the northern regions.
According to a 2021 study in the Journal of Hydrology, the Sahel region is increasingly threatened by floods. The study described widespread havoc and devastation as becoming commonplace.
Reuters correspondent David Doyle. Florida residents hard hit by Hurricane Milton are getting back on their feet. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
In the wake of Hurricane Milton, some Florida areas continue flooding because of cresting rivers. Meanwhile, recovery work continues. Governor Ron DeSantis says the state's disaster fund has raised about $12 million and counting.
Through the disaster fund, we've been able to cut red tape and we've been able to get assistance to people who need it.
He also says power is back for most of the state.
You're even without power for a few hours, it could be a real pain in the rear end, but we had over 50,000 linemen. These folks really got to work.
And free gas is still available at 10 state depots. I'm Julie Walker.
That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barkey in Washington. Today's Wednesday, October 16th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Today is D-Day in the Kenyan Senate, which will decide whether Deputy President Gachagua will be removed from office.
The three judges say that they will give their decision on Wednesday morning whether they are going to stop the Senate from conducting the impeachment trial or not.
Somalia-Ethiopia tensions threaten Turkey's bid to spread its influence. The Confederation of African Football delists Nigeria-Libya qualifier over a mistreatment feud. A debate over LGBTQ rights hits Liberia's United Methodist Church with a crisis. Chad's main opposition calls for postponement of the December 29th parliamentary and municipal elections.
We asked for the election to be postponed simply because 20 of the 23 regional Chad are under flooding right now. So there is no way any political party will be able to respect that time frame to apply for the upcoming election.
And a look at how Republican-leaning Nevada became a swing state. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Today is D-Day in the Kenyan Senate, which will decide whether Deputy President Rigathi Gachagua will be removed from office. He has already been impeached in Parliament. Gachagua says the charges against him are politically motivated. The court yesterday declined to stop Wednesday's Senate trial. However, the Kenyan Nation newspaper reports that the Senate and the country will have to wait for the decision of a three-judge panel at 8 a.m. local time Wednesday morning, whether the Senate can or cannot begin the trial to impeach Gachagua. Political reporter Barack Udwa of the People's Daily explains the cliffhanger to me.
The senators will begin the impeachment process of the deputy president, Mr. Rigathi Gachagua. Already, the Senate clerk, Mr. Jeremiah Nyegenyi, released what I'll call the schedule or the timelines of the activities of. And it is so clear that the Senate is ready to have the process kickstart. What's expected also is that the deputy president and his lawyers, they will be given up to 5 hours to defend themselves. And we are also expecting that all the senators to be present. You can remember that it is a process that will include each and every senator voting on whether to have the deputy president impeached or not.
So there are two court rulings, or one ruling and the other is expected Wednesday morning. What is the difference between these two court decisions?
There are actually two court rulings that took place on Tuesday in Nairobi at the High Court. The first ruling came around 4 p.m. East African time. And it was a ruling that saw the High Court in Nairobi declining to suspend the impeachment trial at Senate. Remember that this particular event is just among the more than 26 attempts to stop the impeachment process by various petitioners who are represented mainly by the lawyers of the deputy president. In this particular court declaration, the court rejected a request by the deputy president. He had gone to court to ensure that he seek what we call conservatory order, stopping the Senate from proceeding with the impeachment, but the court said no, it was not possible. The argument of the deputy president was that these charges at the Senate or this particular impeachment was politically motivated, and they claimed that the process was unconstitutional and it lacked sufficient public participation.
So the court ruling that is expected now for Wednesday morning, I want you to make the distinction between the one that is expected on Wednesday morning and the one that was made already.
I am coming to the second court decision that happened much later in the evening. It was a court decision by three-judge bench. Remember, the Kenyan Chief Justice, Honorable Martha Koome, formed a three-judge bench to decide on the several petitions put forward by various petitioners on the issue of the impeachment of the deputy president. So the more than 26 petitions have been consolidated together into one so that a three-judge bench could hear them. And today in Nairobi, the three judges say that they will give their decision on Wednesday morning at around 8 a.m., just 1 hour to the Senate impeachment process beginning, whether they are going to stop the Senate from conducting the impeachment trial or not.
Barack Odua is the political reporter for the People's Daily of Kenya. He was speaking with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. Turkey is deepening its cooperation with Somalia this month, sending a research ship to look for energy resources. But as Doreen Jones reports from Istanbul, tensions between Somalia and Ethiopia are threatening Ankara's ambitions in the Horn of Africa region.
Turkey's research ship Oruç Reis, escorted by Turkish warships, set sail this month from Istanbul to Somalia to search for what are widely believed to be vast energy reserves. The deployment is part of an energy and security agreement between Turkey and Somalia in what analysts say is an accelerating relationship, but they say growing regional tensions could threaten Ankara's aspirations. That is a warning from geopolitical consultant Norman Rickleffs.
Turkey needs Somalia and Ethiopia to play well together. And so this is vitally important for Turkish regional ambitions.
Tensions have been rising since January when Ethiopia signed a memorandum of understanding with Somaliland, a region that has unilaterally declared independence from Somalia. Under the agreement, Ethiopia would secure sea access in exchange for recognising the breakaway state. Somalia condemns the deal, accusing Ethiopia of infringing on its territorial integrity. Turkey is mediating the conflict, but the dispute is broadening after Egypt started shipping arms to Somalia. Elem Ayrece Tepecioğlu is an African studies professor at the Social Sciences University of Ankara.
Somalia's growing ties with Egypt can provide Somalia leverage to negotiate with Ethiopia on more favorable terms. So it could strengthen Somalia's bargaining power in its negotiations with Ethiopia. So if Egypt deepens its security ties with Somalia, Ethiopia might perceive it as a direct security threat. So this might increase the distrust during the talks.
Egypt is at odds with Ethiopia over its damming of the Nile River. The tensions also threaten Somalia and Ethiopia's military collaboration against the al-Qaeda-linked group al-Shabaab. Analysts say that while Ankara is still well-placed to resolve the tensions because of its good ties with all parties, it needs diplomatic support. Omar Mahmoud, senior Eastern Africa analyst for the International Crisis Group.
Turkey still should be, can still be the lead mediator, but outside actors like the US, like the EU, like those in the Gulf, adding their weight to that to say, okay, look, this has gone on for quite some time. The longer this goes on, the greater the risk of miscommunication or miscalculation and some sort of conflictual outcome.
With Ankara investing heavily in Somalia militarily and diplomatically, analysts warn that any new conflict or even deepening instability in the war-torn region would threaten Turkey's goal of widening its influence. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
The Vice President for Political Affairs and the Diaspora of Chad's Opposition Transformers Party says the Chadian government should postpone the country's December 29th parliamentary and municipal elections. Registration of candidates for those elections take place between October 19 and 28. Dolembay Jasada says 20 of Chad's 23 regions are underwater due to heavy rainfall that has caused the loss of life and cattle. He tells me that Transformers will boycott the election if the government does not agree to postpone the vote.
We believe that our existence as a party depends on elections, but that does not mean we're going to any election without any condition. And based on the experience we had at the past presidential election, and based on some of the electoral laws currently and the composition of the member of the electoral committee, we have a number of requests that has to be taken into account prior to participating in this upcoming legislative and senatorial election. But if those conditions are not taken into consideration, it will be clear to us and to everybody else that we will not participate in the election. That's our position, and we have made that clear over a week ago. And so if other political parties are simply boycotting, we are not boycotting. we are coming around the table with conditions. But those conditions, if they are not taken into consideration, then we will be out, as simple as this could be.
But the elections are coming up on December 29, and you have to submit your candidacy between October 19 and 28. October 19 is just around the corner.
Yeah, one of the conditions to that is that we ask for the election to be postponed, simply because 20 of the 23 regional charter are under flooding right now. So there is no way any political party will be able to respect that time frame to apply for the upcoming election, because many of the regions are cut from their main cities due to the major flooding. That's kind of like a global issue right now. And in Chad, it's even worse. And on top of that, there is a lot of economic loss and life loss and cattle loss due to flooding as we speak. Chad is the number two exporters of cattle. And on top of that, many of the farms have been engulfed by flooding. So in this emergency situation, the government should call a state of emergency and do its best to resolve this issue before even speaking of election. Because it would be an insult to the people to come in this condition and ask them to register or to go and vote if they are completely cut off of the main city where they could vote. As I said, 20 of the 23 regions are underwater. So this is an emergency situation, and our party require the government to postpone those elections.
What are the chances that the government would accept your proposal to postpone the election?
Here's the thing. You already saw a group of political parties saying they are not participating in the upcoming election. And we have this condition prior to participating. But if they continue to go, they will be the only one facing themselves. And what will be the credibility of this such election? So it's up to them to realize. And the people of Chad are not stupid, excuse me the terms, because they know what's happening in the country and they know the situation. I mean, let's be honest. I'm in a situation of distress, and you are coming. How would you get me knowing that I'm already cut off from you due to the flooding? And if they continue down that road, it's basically shooting themselves on the foot.
Dulembai Jesada is the vice president for political affairs in the diaspora of Chad's opposition Transformers Party. He was speaking with me from Atlanta, Georgia. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, October 16th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. A cross-section of the United Methodist Church members in Liberia disrupted worship services this past Sunday following the expulsion of their pastors. Denise Nipson reports from Monrovia.
There have been controversies within the United Methodist Church since its USA chapter endorsed same-sex marriage. On Sunday, October 13, members at two separate branches in the capital, Monrovia, protested the removal of their clergymen after police arrived to enforce the mandate. Reverend Leo Mason is the senior pastor of the New Georgia United Methodist Church. He says the prelate of the Liberia Methodist Church, Samuel Choir, decided to silence him and six other clergymen due to their opposition to same-sex marriage in the church.
At the local church itself, we are two, and then from six different locations today, this identical incident occurred. The bishop of the United Methodist Church, he decided to silence the voice of those who are speaking against regionalization and same-sex marriage. So he decided to serve the local pastors. I and my associate pastor, the letter, to be removed from the local church.
Jefferson Knight, the program director of United Methodist Human Rights, said the claim that the prelate is removing anti-LGBTQ clergymen is misleading. However, he said the pastors are being influenced by a breakaway group and I've been suspended for disrespecting the bishop.
They started agitating because they are part of this breakaway group called the Global Methodist Church in the U.S., but has influence over some of them, some of the individuals who say they want to leave the church because the United Methodist Church at the General Conference in between April to May passed ordination of gay and lesbian pastor in a church in America. So they said we should leave. The bishop should call for special session. So the bishop said, that is unprecedented. Every time when we come for a general conference, we can wait until our annual conference. Then we discuss issues concerning or the outcome of the general conference at our annual conference. But since June, they've been agitating the Global Methodist Church people who are in our church and want to break the church away to the Global Methodist Church, the bishop and the entire leadership of our church said, no, we can't call special session. We'll educate the people about the outcome of the General Conference. Then we go to our annual conference in February 2025.
Addressing the press on Monday, Bishop Samuel Quayle said, regionalization is in no way promoting LGBTQ, noting that Liberia Methodists uphold the biblical principles that speak against same-sex marriage.
The United Methodist Church in Liberia is not a gay church, nor will it ever adopt such an identity. We, as members of the United Methodist Church in Liberia, we firmly uphold the definition of marriage as a sacred union between one man and one woman, nothing more and nothing less.
The incident has sparked a heated discussion across the country. Many believe that Liberia was founded on Christian principles. For Daybreak Africa, I'm Denise Nipsin in Monrovia, Liberia.
The Libyan Football Federation, the LFF, is criticizing Nigeria's decision to withdraw from the 2025 AFCON qualifier in Libya and threatening to take legal action. On Monday, Nigeria's national football team, the Super Eagles, walked off the fixture citing safety concerns. This after being stranded at a local airport in Libya without food and internet access for more than 16 hours. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
Tuesday's statement by the Libyan Football Federation, or LFF, accused its Nigerian counterpart, the Nigerian Football Federation, or NFF, of not cooperating with the local organizers. LFF said the flight diversion was possibly caused by routine aircraft protocols, security checks, or logistical problems beyond their control, adding that Libyan players faced similar challenges in last week's reverse fixture in Nigeria. LFF said it will, quote, take all legal measures to preserve the interests of the Libyan national football team, end quote. On Monday, the Nigerian men's soccer team pulled out of its Confederation of African Football, or CAF, qualifier in Libya and returned home in protest at being abandoned at an airport after their plane was diverted. The NFF said the team was taken to Al Abraq International Airport, 3 hours away from the venue of the match, and that local authorities did not make alternative travel plans for the team. Ademola Olajire is the spokesperson of the NFF.
It's consistent with their usual shenanigans and its characteristics of their very hostile attitude towards other Africans. And we have filed a formal letter. The whole world is aware of what happened, what transpired, and how everything went. And we expect a reasonable and justified decision from CAF.
Libyan authorities also have rejected allegations of foul play or willful attempt to dampen the morale of the Nigerian players ahead of Tuesday's match. The Nigerian Super Eagles were scheduled to take on the Mediterranean Knights of Libya on Tuesday to seal their qualification for the 2025 AFCON finals slated next year in Morocco. On Tuesday, LFF posted on social media that it is match day with the Super Eagles. On Tuesday, CAF delisted the fixture over the ill treatment controversy. Nigerian sports analyst Daniel Aderia says Libya has folded many times in the past.
Historical antecedents, you know, have put them in a very bad spot. It's the most hostile environment anybody can play football. They should go ahead and threaten, because as far as we're concerned, we will not be dim-witted. CAF has said they're going to intervene in the matter. A disciplinary board has been set up to that effect.
On Monday, the CAF said it was talking to both Nigeria and Libya and would take action against the member who violated its rules. Local football club coach Fred Tebbit says Nigeria's diminishing positive public image is to blame.
We should not forget where we belong in the ranks of Africa. A national team of such caliber, with players playing all over the top clubs in Europe, will be treated as such. And I think CAF should take a tough stand on this. Our government is not helping the situation. Our country is full of a lot of stuff, corruption, you know, embezzlement, you know, everything. So the Libyans, now they can measure shoulders with us.
Last Friday, Nigeria defeated Libya 1-0, securing 7 points over 3 games in their group. The top 2 teams in each group will advance to the 24-team finals. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
In the United States, all eyes are on the 7 so-called battleground states that are expected to determine the outcome of the 2024 presidential election. While some of them have shifted politically over the years, the western swing state of Nevada does not lean strongly toward one major party or the other. VOA's Dora McQuarrie reports from Las Vegas.
Nevada, home to 3.1 million people, is probably best known for Las Vegas, its most famous city, also known as Sin City. Tom Riley is a professor and expert on democracy and citizenship at Arizona State University.
But they're a bit of a paradox. I mean, they're seen as perhaps a liberal state in some sense because it was the first state that really pushed no-fault divorce. It has gambling in certain counties. It allows prostitution. But it also has this undercurrent of being very, very conservative in some respects.
Nevada reliably voted Republican from the late 1960s until the early 2000s. Since then, the state regularly swings between the two political parties. Nevada's population has more than tripled since 1980. Many recent newcomers are from predominantly liberal California. Ken Miller is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas.
What's happened is the Clark County, which is the county where Las Vegas sits, is now 72% of the voting population in this state. So what has happened to Nevada is what was once a rural Mountain West state has become an urban West Coast state.
Nevada college student David Cardenas has noticed the state's political split.
There's Vegas, and then there's the rest of Nevada. And from my knowledge, Vegas tends to be more on the Democrat side, whereas the rest of Nevada is more Republican. But then again, most of the population is in Vegas.
Despite the population explosion, Nevada remains heavily working class, with many residents working manual jobs, says UNLV's Miller.
So things like wages, things like unemployment, things like housing affordability, just inflation in general, so things like fuel prices, all of those things affect people a little bit more here in Nevada than they might some other states.
College students at the University of Nevada at Las Vegas outline their top issues. Some will vote for the first time now that they've reached the voting age of 18.
Definitely abortion, definitely the economy, education as well.
The state of economy, probably just the border.
I'm kind of broke college kid. I would just like to be able to better afford food. I would like to be able to have a single job that pays enough to help me with all of my needs.
When they vote in November's general election, Nevadans will also vote on whether to install a right to abortion in the state constitution. Rebecca Gill is director of the Women's Research Institute of Nevada.
The issue overall has already proven to be a big driver, a big motivator of turnout in prior elections, and I think this one will be no different.
Still, Miller says no one should underestimate former President Donald Trump's chances of winning Nevada.
I think that Trump is being perceived as a candidate unlikely to win Nevada simply because he hasn't won the last 2 times. I wouldn't discount the importance of economic issues as driving the decision for voters in this state.
Nevada's critical role as a battleground state is why both presidential nominees, Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris, are spending time here. Because ultimately, what happens in Vegas could determine who will lead America for the next 4 years. Dora McQuarrie, VOA News, Las Vegas.
And that's it for this Wednesday, October 16th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for coming aboard with us this morning. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Button, Washington, wishing that you will have a lovely day.